There's a very comforting lie that we all sort of accept when we start learning about the economy. It's this idea that the financial world is a smooth, rational machine. You have capital on one side, labor on the other, everybody behaves logically, and it all just balances out nicely. It's clean.
It's a beautiful map.
Yeah.
The problem, as is often the case, is that the map doesn't match the territory.
Not even close. And that is exactly what we are digging into today. We're looking at a dense, fascinating text, chapter 16, Asset Prices, by Monica Piazzesi and Martin Schneider. And their mission is pretty bold. They take that standard economic map, what economists call the neoclassical growth model, and they hold it up against the actual messy, chaotic history of the US stock market.
And the results are, well, in the academic world, they call them puzzles. For the rest of us, we might just call them failures.
Or at least massive blind spots, exactly. The model breaks. But understanding how it breaks is where the real value lies for anyone trying to, understand their own portfolio. We're going to look at why stocks return 8% while bonds return 1%, why European portfolios look totally different from American ones, and this concept called the stochastic discount factor.
Sounds terrifying.
It sounds absolutely terrifying, but it's actually the key to understanding the value of literally everything.
It really is. Once you grasp that concept, it changes how you view every dollar you spend or save. It moves you from just looking at price tags to looking at, at utility.
So let's start with the basics. The standard model, the one that simplifies the world, it assumes there's just one thing called capital. It assumes we all just own a slice of the factory. But looking at the data in this chapter, that is clearly nonsense. We own houses, we own stocks, bonds, we have mortgages.
Exactly. We hold specific assets, not abstract capital. Basically, you can't treat the market as one person. The market is a collection of people who are at very different stages of life and living in very different places.
I thought this was fascinating. They break it down by age first. If you look at the life cycle of a typical investor, the portfolio changes drastically. When you're young, say in your 20s or early 30s, what does your balance sheet look like?
Usually, you have very few liquid assets and a lot of debt. You are leveraging yourself to the hilt to buy a house.
Right. You're betting everything on real estate.
So your entire financial existence is concentrated in a single risky asset, your home. You're highly leveraged. But fast forward 30 years. You've paid off the mortgage. Your income has gone up. You have spare cash. Now you start buying stocks.
So the stock market is essentially dominated by older, wealthier households. The market sentiment isn't the sentiment of the average 25-year-old.
Not at all. It's the sentiment of the 55-year-old planning for retirement. And that skew matters.
But the source pointed out something else that I found even more surprising, the international differences. You'd think developed Western economies would look pretty similar, right? But the portfolios in the US versus Germany or Italy are night and day.
They are. I mean, the numbers are so stark. In the US, something like 52% of households own stocks.
But in Germany, it's way lower, and homeownership is all over the place. The US is around 65%. Italy is way up at 75%, but Germany is under 50%.
Germany is a nation of renters compared to Italy.
So why is that? Is it just that Germans are culturally risk averse, or is there something structural going on?
The authors argue it is largely structural, and it comes down to the pension system. This is the pay-as-you-go effect. In the U.S., over the last few decades, we've shifted to a model where you are responsible for your retirement. You get a 401k, you have to pick stocks or bonds. You are effectively forced into the asset market.
Whereas in many parts of Europe, the pension is funded by taxes on current workers.
Exactly. If the government guarantees your income in old age, effectively a bond-like promise, you have zero incentive to deal with the volatility and stress of the stock market. So you don't.
You just keep your money in the bank.
It really highlights that market participation isn't just about how savvy investors are. It's about the rules of the game they're forced to play.
So the player base of the market changes depending on where you are. But let's talk about the score. Let's talk about valuation. If we have all these different assets, houses, stocks, how do we know what they're worth? The text uses a metric called price to cash flow.
This is a great reality check metric. For stocks, it's price to dividend. For houses, it's price to rent. Basically, how much are you paying for a dollar of flow?
And if you look at their chart, which tracks these ratios over nearly a century, the big takeaway is that they do not move in lockstep.
They really don't. And that disproves the single capital theory right there.
I was looking at the late 1990s on that chart. It's glaring. Stock prices detached from reality. The price-to-dividend ratio went through the roof.
The dot-com bubble.
We all remember it. But housing, it was flat. Relative to rents, housing was cheap.
Right. If you were viewing the world through that single capital asset model, you'd miss that entirely. You would just see wealth going up. But in reality, one asset class was in a speculative mania and the other was on sale.
Okay, so markets are distinct, but there has to be a unifying theory of value. The chapter goes deep into the math here, talking about no arbitrage and state prices. I want to translate this because I think it's the most important concept for a listener to grasp.
It is the unified theory of finance, in a way. It starts with the concept of no free lunch.
Which is the one rule economics never breaks.
Theoretically, if there was a way to make a guaranteed profit without risk, everyone would do it. The prices would converge. Because of that law, we can derive state prices.
This is where we get into Arrow's securities.
Right. Imagine a ticket that pays you $1. But there's a catch. It only pays you that dollar if it rains tomorrow.
Okay. So I'm betting on the state of the world.
Exactly. Now, expand that to the economy. You can buy a ticket, an asset, that pays you a dollar only if there's a recession, or a ticket that pays you only if there's a boom.
And common sense says those tickets would have different prices.
Drastically different.
Yeah.
And this leads us to the hungry factor, or what the economists formally call the stochastic discount factor.
Let's use the analogy from the text because it makes this click instantly. It's about hunger.
Think of it this way. I offer you a sandwich, but you just finished a huge Thanksgiving dinner. You are stuffed.
Yeah.
You can't eat another bite. What is that sandwich worth to you?
Zero. I might even pay you to take it away. My marginal utility for food is basically negative.
Okay. Now, scene two. You have been lost in the woods for 3 days. You haven't eaten a thing. You are starving. What's that same sandwich worth now?
Everything. Everything I have in my wallet. My watch, my shoes. I'd give anything.
That difference, that is the stochastic discount factor. A dollar isn't always a dollar. A dollar when you were full, when the economy is booming, you have a job, is worth very little to you. You discount it.
But a dollar when you are starving, when there's a recession, you lost your job, the market crashed, that dollar is incredibly valuable. This completely redefines risk, doesn't it? Most people think risk is just volatility, things bouncing up and down.
Yes. But the authors emphasize covariance. That is the critical distinction. Variance is just movement. Covariance is movement relative to your hunger.
Let's apply that to insurance versus stocks because that really cements it.
Perfect example. Car insurance is an asset. You buy a policy. But think about when it pays you.
It only pays me when I crash my car, when I'm having a terrible day, when I have a huge financial liability, when I'm hungry.
Exactly. It pays out when your marginal utility for money is high. It has a negative covariance with your wealth. It goes up when your life goes down.
Do you accept a negative return on it?
You happily pay more in premiums than you ever expect to get back. You pay for the safety.
And stocks are the exact opposite.
Stocks are the fair weather friend.
Yeah.
Think about it. When do stocks pay huge returns?
When the economy is booming. When everyone is employed. When I'm probably getting a bonus at work.
When you are already full. Stocks hand you a sandwich right after Thanksgiving dinner. But when the recession hits, when you lose your job and you are starving,
the stock market crashes. It takes the sandwich away exactly when you need it most.
Precisely. So because stocks have this positive covariance with the economy, they perform well when you're already doing well, you demand a huge discount to buy them. You demand a premium.
That's the equity premium. You aren't getting 8% a year because you're smart. You are getting paid 8% a year as compensation for the fact that this asset will betray you in a crisis.
Yeah, it's a sobering thought.
It is, but, and this is the big twist in the deep dive. This is where the chapter takes a turn. The authors try to fit this beautiful, hungry agent theory to the actual data of U.S. history. And the puzzle pieces don't fit.
They don't just not fit. They basically demonstrate that the standard model is broken. This brings us to the equity premium puzzle.
So let's look at the numbers. We've established that we demand a premium for stocks because we're afraid of starving in a recession. But looking at the data from, 1929 to 2023, U.S. consumption is actually really smooth.
Very smooth.
It grows about 2% a year. We don't actually starve that often.
Right. We are a stable, wealthy country. Even in recessions, aggregate consumption doesn't drop that much. So if our consumption is smooth, if we aren't actually that terrified of starving, why do we demand such a massive premium for stocks?
The gap is huge. It's 7% between stocks and risk-free bonds.
It is. To explain that 7% gap, using the standard model, just how scared would you have to be?
Oh, terrified. The risk aversion coefficient, a number economists use to measure fear, would have to be something like 50 or 100.
Right. And for context, reasonable economic models usually put it around 2, maybe 5 at a stretch.
So to justify the stock market returns we see, we'd have to be hyper-neurotic, panicking over every tiny fluctuation in our daily latte budget. But we aren't.
No. We seem relatively calm. So that's puzzle one. The reward is too high for the apparent risk, which leads directly to puzzle two, the risk-free rate.
The domino effect.
Exactly. If we just assume investors were that terrified just to make the stock math work, then logic dictates they should be acting terrified in other ways. Specifically, they should be desperately trying to save money.
Right. If I'm that scared of the future, I'm hoarding cash. I'm buying safe bonds.
You would be desperate to smooth out your consumption. And that massive demand for savings should drive the interest rate on safe bonds. Sky high.
Wait, walk me through that. If everyone wants bonds, shouldn't the yield go down?
In the real world, yes. But in the model, there's a strange linkage between risk aversion and what's called intertemporal substitution, basically your patience.
Yeah.
If you make the agent terrified enough to explain the stock market, the model implies they'd also be so desperate for safety that, well, the bottom line is the model predicts the risk-free interest rate should be something like 4 or 5% or even much higher.
But the real risk-free rate historically is like 1%.
Exactly. So you have a contradiction. You can't match the high stock returns and the low bond yields with the same human psychology. The model says we can't be both terrified of stocks and comfortable with low interest rates at the same time.
The text mentions a fix for this, something called Epstein's Inn preferences.
Yes.
It sounds like a sci-fi concept, but what does it actually do?
It essentially performs surgery on the model. In the standard model, your fear of risk and your willingness to save are locked together. Epstein's Inn utility cuts that link. It lets you have an investor who is very afraid of risk, which explains the high stack premium.
But who isn't necessarily desperate to smooth consumption in a way that breaks the interest rate?
Exactly. It's a mathematical patch. It makes the data fit better, but it's essentially admitting the standard model is too rigid to capture human behavior.
Then we have the third failure, the excess volatility puzzle. This is the one that won Robert Shiller a Nobel Prize.
And this is the one that really challenges the rational market hypothesis. Think about it. The price of a stock is theoretically just the present value of its future dividends.
Right. It's the cash I expect to get.
And we know from the data that dividends are tucking. Well, they're boring. They are stable. They grow slowly. Their volatility is around 2%.
But stock prices, they look like an EKG of a heart attack.
Exactly. Stock prices have a volatility of around 18%. So you have a stable input dividends and a wildly unstable output prices. The math doesn't add up.
So that the cash flow isn't changing, the only thing that can be changing is the discount rate? The way we value that cash.
That's the Shiller insight. The market is moody. One day wakes up and values a future dollar of dividends at 90 cents. The next day it gets spooked and values it at 50 cents. Nothing changed at the company. The change happened in the investor's head.
Which implies that price movements are largely driven by changes in risk appetite, not changes in fundamental news.
That seems huge. It is huge. It implies that most of the market movement is just us wrestling with our own psychology.
That leads us to the final part of the chapter, predictability. Usually we're told you can't time the market. But if prices are just random psychological noise, surely we can't predict them.
Well, the source suggests that isn't strictly true if you adjust your timeline.
Tell me about that chart they show.
It's the smoking gun. It plots the dividend yield, which is dividends divided by price against future returns. When the dividend yield is high, it means prices are low relative to the cash the company generates.
So stocks are cheap.
Exactly. When stocks are cheap by this metric, the data shows that excess returns over the next 5 to 7 years tend to be high, predictably high.
So value investing works.
Over the long term, yes. The predictive power is almost zero for next week or next month.
Mm-hmm.
But over 5 to 10 years, it's significant. If you buy when yields are low, like the dot-com bubble, your 10-year returns are almost guaranteed to be terrible.
So the random walk is really just noise masking a long-term signal. But why? Why does the discount rate bounce around so much? The text throws out three theories.
The first is that maybe the world actually is riskier at some times than others. Maybe the danger of starvation fluctuates. But as we saw with consumption data, that's hard to prove.
The second theory was sentiment.
Right. Maybe we just have irrational waves of optimism and pessimism, ambiguity aversion. We just get scared.
Which feels the most true to life, honestly.
It does. And the third is preference shocks. This is the economist trying to stay rational. They suggest that maybe people literally wake up some days more patient or less risk-averse than others.
It's interesting that to explain the hard numbers of Wall Street, we ultimately have to resort to maybe people just feel different today.
It is humbling. We went from a nice, neat model with straight lines to admitting that human preference might just be a random variable we can't fully pin down.
I want to leave listeners with one specific thought from the end of the chapter that I found slightly mind-bending. We talked about how, to explain the stock market, we need to assume investors are terrified of risk, high risk aversion.
Right.
But then the text mentions how Wall Street banks price options and derivatives. When they use the Black-Scholes model, they use something called risk-neutral probabilities.
Ah, yes, the mathematical trick.
They literally pretend risk doesn't exist to make the equation solvable.
It is the ultimate irony of finance. To explain the equity premium, why stocks are cheap, we have to assume you are a nervous wreck who needs a massive payout to take any risk.
But to price the option on that same stock, the bankers use a model that assumes you are a completely unfeeling robot who doesn't care about risk at all.
And somehow the system keeps spinning using both assumptions at once.
It suggests that all these models, whether it's the textbook growth model or the complex option pricing, they aren't laws of nature.
No, they aren't physics. They're just different lenses we swap out to try to make sense of human behavior.
And none of them are perfect. But understanding why they fail, understanding that hungry factor, is probably the best edge an investor can have.
I agree. It forces you to look at your portfolio and ask, is this protecting me from starvation, or is it just another sandwich when I'm full?
That is the question. Does your portfolio have positive or negative covariance with your life? Something to chew on. That's it for this deep dive into Chapter 16. Thanks for listening.